Hello and welcome to Outside In. This is I can't believe this. This is episode 12, I think. It feels like, and I haven't produced one for every day of lockdown. You'd be glad to know, but I'll be having on the show. Very pleased to see Helen Mort, poet and novelist, later on. We'll be talking about lots of things, how boredom can drive you to artistic achievement, amongst other things. She's a climber as well, an outdoor person. So I'm really looking forward to that. I have to admit, I have been pretty bored. I found myself dusting the tops of my pictures today. I don't think they've been dusted for, well, in living memory, to be honest. I'm not by nature a house proud person. You might think that I am, but I'm not. As far as I'm concerned, in my kitchen, if you can go in there and make yourself a sandwich and a bowl of soup and walk out without food poisoning, that's about the level I'm looking for. If you get food poisoning, well, I'll go in with the domestos. You know what I mean? It's Monday today, I think. I'm fairly certain. And I'm looking forward to going to Narissa's yoga class tonight. I find it very useful, very relaxing. I'm not really a person, when God designed me, he wasn't thinking of yoga, to be frank. I'm more designed for comfort than speed, you know. Fairly robust person, you know, but flexibility is not really my strength. You know, the only way I could get my foot behind my head would be if I was in a car crash. Right, without more ado, here's my little interview with Helen Mort. Well, we've got poet, climber and novelist Helen Mort on the show. Hello, Helen.
Hi.
And how are things with you? Where is it you live?
I live in Sheffield, right on the side, where you can get out quite quickly to the Peak District. So it's a pretty good place to be. Right. Even at the moment, in the middle of a lockdown, I can run my daily exercise. I can run out from my house up towards the sort of nearest side of Burbage. And just even seeing the hills in the distance is really nice.
Yeah, you can get out quite well. That's good. That's great. I mean, in fact, where I live, in the middle of Inverness, I don't think I could run as far as Burbage, but I can see the hills in the distance here.
And yeah,
it's a bit tantalising, really. I can see them, but I can't go there. So it's a bit, and it's a mixed blessing, I have to say.
yeah, exactly.
Well, what got you into the outdoors then?
It's my dad, really. I grew up in Chesterfield, so not that far from here. Yeah. And my dad's a keen hill walker and particular fan of climbing Munros and stuff like that.
Oh,
so
right.
From very, very young, from as soon as I could walk, really, he would take me up mountains. And then when I was a bit older, we'd go and we'd do the Munros together and we'd go on some amazing trips and amazing family holidays, really. Yeah.
Oh right, well you must.
And he also got me into running because he was a runner too. And so I started sort of through school, but then I was in. I think it's the example, isn't it? If you see one of your parents,
yeah,
doing things like that all the time, it kind of just seems normal to you.
Yes, that's right. I did see some research somewhere that said if you don't get into the outdoors when you're a child, before you're 8. The chances are pretty slim, so obviously your early experience was quite good.
Yeah, I mean, my mum was interested in sport as well. She was a really good badminton player and she was quite outdoorsy. I actually read something recently which I found interesting, which said that the mother's exercising has more of an impact even than father's does on whether a child becomes interested in sport or not. So I thought that's fascinating. My mum was definitely an influence on that too, I think. Yeah.
So you've got a toddler yourself at the moment, is that right?
I have, yes.
Oh,
Having a nap.
Well, I'm sure that, let's hope we can get the interview done before they wake up.
Oh, yeah, don't worry.
So it's hopefully you have quite an influence on it. Now, obviously, what sort of got you into writing? Because you're a poet and a novelist and you teach creative writing, is that correct?
I do, yeah. I teach at Manchester Met.
Oh, right.
Sort of something that I've done as long as I can remember, but I think it came from my love of reading, really, because I was an only child, so I used to spend quite a lot of time, as only children do, that have
Yes.
left to my own devices. And so I would spend a lot of time outside, actually, but I'd also spend a lot of time reading because that just, again, that just seemed sort of normal to me. It was something that I could
Yeah.
do on my own. So I think it was a natural sort of progression from that, really, from reading poets that I admired. And a lot of them were writers who, so my dad got me into the Scottish poet Norman McCaig, who's a brilliant, brilliant writer of Scottish landscapes and of the hills in particular. And so I think that probably influenced not just that I wanted to write, but maybe the kinds of things that I wanted to write about as well.
Yeah, that's interesting because I was an only child as well, and I think
Okay.
I wasn't particularly into reading as much. I did read
Yeah.
some stuff, but I think I developed a really powerful like internal imaginative world,
Yeah.
which I think you kind of do if you're an only child.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good. The singer, songwriter, artist Richard Hawley, who lives in Sheffield, who I really, really admire,
Okay.
always talks about the value of getting bored for creativity. And he says we're not living in a very creative world at the moment because we're not encouraged to be bored.
We're not bold enough. That's probably
We're
great.
not bored. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, this virus lockdown probably
Yeah.
will generate some of the finest literature ever written, I should imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely. Although I do keep getting fed up of hearing about how Shakespeare wrote, I forgot what he wrote, but he wrote something during the plague. And I was thinking Shakespeare definitely didn't have a toddler, because it has
No,
a
no.
different sort of lockdown. But yeah, absolutely right. I think it's interesting that people are turning to, well, people are just being more creative at the moment, and it's no accident. It is because of the boredom, which is
Well, that's right.
great in a way.
Well, here I am interviewing poets over Zoom. I mean, what can you
Yeah,
and how creative
exactly.
can you be? And you've written, am I right, two collections of poetry, is that right? Or possibly more?
Yeah, no, two. That's right. The second one came out a few years ago in 2016, and
Right.
it was partly inspired by, I wanted to write about women's stories of mountaineering, sort of
Right, yeah.
historically, kind of. Yeah, that's not the whole book, but it was part of the emphasis, and I really enjoyed researching it and finding out about some of those stories. I also wrote quite a lot about Alison Hargreaves, the
Oh yes.
late great mountaineer, who's a big inspiration to me as well.
Oh, I mean, there've been some mountaineering is a sport really where there have been, I suppose it is male dominated still like a lot of sports, but there have been
Yeah.
some very significant figures, female figures in the world of mountaineering. Alison Hargreaves being one of
Absolutely.
them.
Yeah, I got really interested in her whole life, really, and the way that, just how inspirational she was as a climber, but how she balanced motherhood and mountaineering. And that's something I've carried on writing about. So I'm working on a non-fiction project at the moment that's due out in a couple of years, and that's partly inspired by looking at the history of motherhood and mountaineering and what happens to how we view risk-taking in mums and stuff like that. So it's been quite interesting to try and.
That's I think that's a whole can of worms is maybe the way.
It is.
It's a very
It's a
difficult.
great big can of worms.
I mean, I think we think nothing or don't think of a man as a mountaineer taking risks, but there seems
Yeah.
to be something very different for a mother doing that. And I
Yeah.
don't know. Well, I do know why that is because we have
Yeah.
stereotype views of roles,
Yeah.
but.
Yeah.
I can remember when I first read, I think it might have been Gwen Moffat's book. I don't know.
Oh, yes.
When I was very young, I didn't even know women could do that sort of thing at that.
Yeah. She's an amazing, inspirational figure, isn't she? I love her writing as well. It's really lively, and yeah, there's some fantastic books. But yeah, when I started reading mountaineering literature, it was mostly books by men, I think. And it
Yes.
was only
Oh, I
later
suppose
on
it
that I
has.
realised and went, "Hang on a minute, I've not been reading." And then I sort of deliberately started to seek those other books out. And
Yes, that's right.
yeah.
I mean, it was mountaineering has been one of the few sports that although it's got a heavily male bias. I mean, there were women climbing in the Victorian era. I mean, that was, you know, early on.
So absolutely.
It's been one, I suppose, a sport that's been a little less discriminatory than most, you know, but still fairly biased. I'm sure the Alpine Club, for example, were mostly men for quite some time.
Yeah, the Alpine Club didn't admit women until I forget when. But also, I suppose it's interesting that a few years ago, I did a trip around the Alps wearing a replica crinoline. Oh, crinoline wow. dress, following in the footsteps of a woman who'd done a trek in the Alps called Jemima Morrell.
Oh, man.
I sort of tried going up some hills wearing a crinoline skirt of the kind that those early Victorian climbers would have been wearing. Yeah, and I had enough trouble getting through doorways or sitting down on a chair, never mind climbing. So I was full of admiration for how they kind of...
Now, I understand you've a book coming out in October. What's that about?
It's called Never Leave the Dog Behind. And it's about why we like having adventures with dogs outdoors and how dogs are part of our fascination with mountains and sort of vice versa.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea of dogs being in their element.
Well, exactly. I mean, yeah, when a dog's out on the hills, it's very much out in nature and they love that. And, and there is something, I'm going to put it, I think it does enhance your experience sometimes to be with a dog.
Yeah, do you have dogs or have you?
I've had dogs in the past. I've got dogs now, but I do go to a lot of bothies and dogs and bothies go together quite a lot. There's usually a dog, usually semi-conscious, lying in front of the fire wherever you go. You know? They do have a thing about heat.
There's something about them being able to run free in the way that perhaps we'd like to ourselves. And dogs are completely unself-conscious when they're in the mountains.
Yeah, they're very much in the moment, dogs, aren't they?
Yeah, completely.
No forward thinking whatsoever.
No. And no sense of danger.
Was this book, it was inspired by a sort of rescue of a dog, is that right?
Yeah, I used to have a phobia of dogs, quite bad. Okay. Until... my whole life, I think I was knocked down by a farm dog when I was small and pinned to the ground. I don't remember, but my mum thinks that might have been what started it off. I was just so afraid. I just used to, if I saw a dog coming, I'd run into the road and cross the road rather than rather than go near it. So I got to about 25, I think, and I was living in the Lake District at the time.
Right.
And I just decided... the only way I'm going to get over this is if I get a dog. So I adopted a dog from the Wainwright Shelter.
Okay.
A whippet called Belle. And the book is partly about that as well. It's about how she became part of my sense of, my whole way of relating to that landscape, I suppose. And going outdoors and how she accompanied me on all those trips. I have to say, whippets aren't the best mountaineering dogs, probably. They're quite wimpy. They're lovely, but they're not designed for cold, for a start. They've got very thin fur, and they've got spindly legs, and they're quite shivery and can be a little bit nervous. So they're probably not the hardiest dogs. But mine went on some amazing runs and... quite big distances with me, which considering they're sprinting dogs is very impressive.
Well, tell me about this rescue then. What happened on this rescue of this dog?
She was seven when I rescued her. She had been kept outdoors in a shed and used as a breeding dog.
Sorry, I was talking about a mountain rescue, the other dog.
Oh, sorry, the mountain rescue. So the book follows... It follows me learning about search and rescue dogs in the UK, sort of in the lakes and here. And I interview a man called Paul Besley, who's in the Woodhead Mountain Rescue.
Right.
And he, when I was interviewing him, he was training his dog Scout to be a search and rescue dog. And so he was he was at the time when I was talking to Paul, Scout hadn't passed the tests yet to be a qualified search and rescue dog, but in the time in between he has, so he's now a qualified search and rescue dog. I also went to Switzerland and walked with St Bernards and sort of explored the history of the St Bernard breed a little bit, and how they've got a rich history as rescue dogs and how they're not really used anymore for mountain rescue.
Was the legend of the little barrel of brandy they used to carry, is that true?
Well, sadly, no, I don't think so.
Oh, what a shame.
I asked a few people about that, and I think it was a bit of an apocryphal thing, but certainly be useful.
It would. I have to say, if you lost on a hillside and a dog turned up with a barrel of brandy, I'd be quite chuffed.
That's exactly what you need, yeah. They're not used as much now because favour dogs that can be put in helicopters, and obviously
St. Bernard,
a St. Bernard isn't a great breed for...
You wouldn't want to heave a St. Bernard in out of a helicopter, I can understand.
No, but they still keep St. Bernards up at the St. Bernard Pass. You can still go and meet them and walk with them, but once upon a time they were the kind of heart and soul of that particular of that area, and they were celebrated.
I've heard quite a few tales of people who've been, you know, stuck out or got lost in really bad weather and have survived because they've sort of kept warm with a dog. I think that's perfect, isn't it? And Saint Bernard,
absolutely,
there's plenty of Saint Bernard to get cuddled into, I would have thought.
There are a lot of stories of people surviving because of their dogs, but actually the book Never Leave the Dog Behind, the book starts with an account of a man in the Lake District in the era of Wordsworth, etc., who went out into the hills with his spaniel and never came back, but then the dog was found and his bones were found. It turned out the dog, he'd fallen, and then the dog had survived by eating his master. So
fair enough.
I kind of I got really interested in why we prefer the heroic stories to those kind of gruesome stories, because I think we do. There's a lot of preference for the kind of heroic man's best friend narrative as well. And we're very sentimental about dogs as a culture, I think
absolutely yeah. Well, they're they form relationships with people like nothing on earth. I mean, there's something special about a man and dog together, isn't there? Is there some way that there's a Kickstart project? Is there some way people can get involved with this book themselves? How does that work?
Yeah, so Vertebrates, who are publishing the book, and when it comes out in the autumn, they've got, you can find it through their website or through them on Twitter, or through my Twitter. They've got a Kickstarter page set up where if you donate to the book, you can have a picture of you and your dog, or of your dog, printed in your own special copy. So it's a kind of personalised copy of the book. And there's also a chance, one of the rewards they're offering is a day out with Scout, who's this beautiful dog that belongs to Paul, who I mentioned earlier, who was the model for the cover of the book as well. We had a great day taking photos of me and Scout running on the hills in the absolutely freezing cold. And I fell in an icy bog and all sorts of stuff like that. So it was very eventful.
He's a sheepdog, is that right?
He's a collie. He's very beautiful. Very, very beautiful. Very friendly. Intelligent, as they all are.
You obviously
he's great.
Urge to bring him home with you, I can tell.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But he's very much a one-person dog. He's completely loyal and devoted to his master.
I bet.
And they have a very special relationship, which is lovely. It's amazing seeing them work together, because it very much is about the relationship. It's not just about the dog being good at what it does or about the handler. It's the combination of them together, which is wonderful to see.
So it sounds like it would make a great present for somebody who goes in the hills with a dog to get a dog.
Or just for anyone who's interested in dogs in general. I don't think you even have to be a hill enthusiast to enjoy some of the stories in there.
That's great.
And as I say, some of it's about, especially for anyone who's who's been afraid of dogs. It's very much like sort of how anyone can end up being a dog owner, and anyone can fall in love with dogs, even if, you know, you wouldn't predict it when they were younger.
No. So that's okay. That sounds great. That sounds really interesting. And that's coming out around about October this year, is that correct?
Yes, that's the plan. Yes, circumstances permitting, it'll be, you know, everything's quite up in the air at the moment, isn't
well,
it? But
yes,
the plan is
yes,
certainly obviously. To publish it in the autumn, yeah.
Great. Okay.
And well, we're hoping to launch it at the Kendal Mountain Festival, so great. That will be good.
That'd be brilliant. I might see you there. Who knows?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, hope so.
Hope so. Anyway, okay, thank you for talking to me. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Okay, thanks. That's Helen Moore.
Well, thanks very much to Helen Moore for coming on the little programme. Hope you enjoyed that interview. I was only thinking about what she was saying about, you know, the bond between dogs and man. And I think, I'm thinking about it a bit more. I think probably it's like a primeval thing. You know, it goes back thousands of years to when, you know, men and dogs worked together. And, well, when I say men, I mean men and women, people. And, you know, dogs would help guard camps and hunt down food, and they'd bark when there were bears about. It's very similar today. My neighbour's dog, you know, it barks when the ice cream van goes past. Quite handy. Anyway, I've been John Burns. Do hope you've enjoyed my little podcast, and I'll hope to see you again. Bye bye.